Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to talk about wildlife on the show today, but a reminder that our WPR and NPR news teams are following election results very closely. So as votes in the election continue to be counted, we'll report on developments throughout the day. And I hope you'll join us tonight at 8 o'clock for an NPR election update special with the latest election news from around the country here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Or, of course, you can go online anytime and get the latest at WPR.org. Certainly, everybody's following the elections. But we're going to talk about wildlife today on the show because there's quite a bit to talk about there with our two guests, David Drake and Jamie Knack. David is professor of forest and wildlife ecology at UW-Madison and a UW Extension wildlife specialist. David, welcome back.
Larry, it's good to be here, and hopefully we can provide people a distraction for 90 minutes.
All right, I hope so. Jamie Knack, a UW Extension senior wildlife outreach specialist. She's also in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. And Jamie, welcome back to you.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be back on the show.
Lots to talk about today, and certainly as you listen to these two experts, I hope you'll join in with your own questions. You can call us at 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, the gray wolf has been delisted nationally, and I'm wondering what led to that decision. Jamie, do you want to take that? Or David?
Sure, yep. Yeah, I'll take this. So, so the gray wolf is just announced that as of yesterday, it's been delisted. There's a 60-day waiting period, so nothing can be done until January 4th of 2021. And essentially what delisting means is that now if both the tribes in Wisconsin and Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, if they choose to do so, they can now enact lethal management. So that would include, for example, that if somebody sees a wolf depredating one of their cattle, they can lethally take care of the wolf. There could be a responsible and sustainable harvest season, either through trapping and or hunting, things like that. And likely those discussions are in motion right now within the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. And obviously the DNR must coordinate with the tribes here in the state of Wisconsin. But likely if something does happen in terms of a harvest season, nothing will occur until likely the fall of 2021. So it'll be a while still. But essentially what's allowed this to happen is that the wolf population is large enough that they can sustain a harvest, or that they're large enough that they can their population is reproductively viable, that they can be removed from the endangered species list. And I should mention quickly, this is the fourth time that they've been on the endangered species list. They've been both on the state endangered and threatened species list, and they've been on the federal endangered and threatened species list. And the first harvest season we had was in 2012, and then that was followed by 2013 and 2014. And I should mention that the reason they've been on the endangered species list, in my professional opinion, has more to do with the social and political and legal challenges to the Endangered Species Act than it does have to do with biology and the objective science. So the wolf population does not necessarily and should not have been on the endangered species list, in my opinion, because the population was viable enough and was large enough that it was not necessary to be on the Endangered Species Act, Endangered Species List. It was there solely because of legal challenges.
So what is the population in the state, and how does it match up with what the goals of the state have been in terms of numbers of gray wolves?
Yeah, you have to go back quite a way. So the current population, is it's an estimate, and it's based off of a variety of different ways that they collect data. But the current population is just shy of 1,200 wolves in the state of Wisconsin, organized in what the DNR thinks is 256 packs, primarily across the northern forested region of the state, and then also in that central forest region that's centered around Black River Falls. So roughly about 1,200, just shy of 1,200 wolves in the state of Wisconsin now. There is a wolf management recovery plan that was authored in 1999, and it was addended in 2007. And there's different benchmarks. And even before the 1999 plan, there was a plan before that. But there are different benchmarks and have been since the wolf kind of reintroduced itself into the state of Wisconsin in the mid-70s. And the first benchmark was if the wolf population got to 80 wolves and maintained at least 80 wolves or more for 3 years, then it would go from state endangered to state threatened. And then it was benchmarked at 250 wolves, and then it was benchmarked at 350 wolves. And because of a number of factors, but because of both federal protection because of the Endangered Species Act initially, because of incredibly wonderful management by the tribes, by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, by the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and again, the protection of the legal frameworks afforded the wolf population by both the federal and state endangered and threatened species laws, the population has grown annually since the protection was put in place in 1973 with the initial Endangered Species Act. So the population has been on a pretty steady incline in terms of growth and has gotten us to this point where now we're roughly at 1,200 wolves, which has far exceeded that 350 benchmark that was set for delisting.
So we won't know a lot for a month or two then probably about what the plans will be out of Wisconsin or for Wisconsin?
So there's a two-month waiting period by law. There has to be a two-month waiting period. So they just got delisted yesterday, and now there's a 60-day waiting period. And so nothing can be done. So on January 4th, 2021, if the DNR wanted to say, all right, on January 4th, we're going to have a harvest season, they're legally allowed to do that. But my understanding is that the DNR is in discussions right now internally, as well as with their Wolf Advisory Panel Committee, which is a myriad of NGOs and conservationists and scientists and tribes and biologists, and in consultation with the tribes. They need to work out exactly if they are going to have a harvest, if they're going to have a harvest, what's the limit, when would that occur, how would it occur, and all things like that. And so there's a lot of complicated machinations that are still yet to be understood. And so that's why likely, if there is a harvest, which there likely will be, it won't be until the fall of 2021 at the earliest.
Our guest today, yeah, go ahead, Jamie.
Sorry, I was just going to add a couple of things. So on January 4th, this will allow the Department of Natural Resources to work with the USDA Wildlife Services to begin immediately both proactive and reactive lethal removal in cases of livestock depredation or depredations to pets, and also to issue landowner permits to remove nuisance animals. And so that will occur. And then by state statute, we do need to have, if they are delisted, we are mandated by state statute to have a wolf season. It's a discussion now in terms of when that would occur. And it is looking like that would be fall 2021. Because as David mentioned, there's a number of things that still need to happen. Quota setting and approval by the Natural Resources Board in terms of what that season structure looks like. So, and then I did just want to mention that, you know, sometimes, first of all, wolves are a very contentious issue, and folks tend to either love them or have conflict or issues to the point where they prefer to see them removed on the landscape. And I think it's important that we respect both of those views. Certainly, wolves have intrinsic value. Many people associate a wolf as a sense of wilderness. They have cultural significance to the Ojibwe people and many other tribes in the state. And yet, there's times where they cause conflict, obviously, with livestock and domestic animals. And we've seen those complaints, not significantly, but at least continue or increase through the time here. So being able to have some control over those situations will certainly benefit the overall wolf, I believe, will benefit the wolf acceptance in the state to begin with. But what I really wanted to mention here is that just because the wolf becomes or is delisted does not mean the wolf will be unprotected. So the DNR will still need to manage both by biological and social objectives. and they'll have that regulated harvest. But that harvest is regulated. You have to have a tag. You have to have a permit to be able to harvest. So it's not that they've become an unprotected species. They'll actually become, I believe, a game species. I don't know that it'll be a fur bear, but it'll be a game species. I'm not clear on what that designation will be, but they will be a protected animal with some provisions for harvest or lethal removal in the case of nuisance situations. So,
yeah, it's good addition.
That's a good point. I should also mention that the United States Fish and Wildlife Service also monitors the population for the next 5 years, and they also have the ability to kind of give their input as to whether the population is declining at a more precipitous rate than they wish or whatever the case might be. So as Jamie says, there's definitely legal frameworks and protections and immense monitoring that will occur for 5 years and beyond, even though the population is off the endangered species list.
David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today. We've been talking about wolves, but we'll take other questions as well or comments from you as we move along today. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I think Tom in Green Bay has a different topic. Let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for having the show, and thank you for taking my call. I have a question. A friend of mine went to his deer blind, and on his way out to his deer blind, he came across a badger den. Now, I'd love to shoot pictures of that badger. However, I don't want to interfere with anybody's hunt. Do badgers remain active throughout the winter, and will it be there in the spring, or will it move on to someplace else?
So that's
Jamie,
a really
–
sure, I'd be happy to. So that's a great observation. Badger dens, it can be difficult to determine whether it's a badger or a coyote or a fox or what animal is digging that hole. In generalities, a badger den tends to be more oval in shape, as the animal itself is very squat and oval-shaped as compared to like a coyote. But they are not true hibernators. So, and we'll probably talk about some of animals' adaptations or strategies for surviving the winter later in the show. But just like skunks and raccoons and possums, they will use a den or a brush pile somewhere where they may hold up for a while. And then on warm days like we have right now, which most animals are not hibernating this early anyway, but they would be out on the landscape searching for some food and then go back and return to the den. But your question is, first of all, we don't know if that den is still active. You could rake the stand in that area, put up a trail camera if you wanted, and monitor those photos and look for tracks. And you'd see the claw, the long claw marks. The distance between the toe pad and the claw would be an indication of a badger. And to see if it's still active. And I would presume these animals use multiple dens or areas throughout the winter. But come spring, that animal is likely to stay in that general area, maybe not that den, but in that general, within a couple of miles area.
So it's possible. And David, you were going to add something.
I was just going to make mention, and it may not even be a den, because badgers also dig a tremendous number of holes as they hunt for things like chipmunks and 13-line ground squirrels and other animals like that. So just because it's a hole in the ground, and even if it is created by a badger, it may not be a den as much as it is an exploration or a pursuit of some of their prey.
So I like the trail cam idea. That might be a way to just determine once and for all what you got there, Tom. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Waupaca. Oops, I'm sorry. We'll go to Nancy in Madison next. Hi, Nancy. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. I have recently seen some programs on PBS that showed the reintroduction of predators into landscapes has really helped the flora, the fauna, helped control populations of different animals that were getting out of sync. How has that affected the wolves affected Wisconsin?
Okay.
Getting into Wisconsin.
All right, David, you want to talk about that first? Or
Yeah, go ahead, David.
Jamie, do you want to? You sure?
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. So the wolves, you know, they were extirpated, which essentially means that they were eliminated from a portion of their range, but not their entire range. So wolves were extirpated from the portion of the range that included Wisconsin. And then about the mid-1970s, they started to come back into Wisconsin, most likely from Minnesota, as the population of wolves increased in Minnesota. And because these animals are territorial, if the animal can't establish territory, they need to move out of that area and establish a new territory where other existing animals are not, or there are fewer of them. And so they came into Wisconsin because it was devoid of wolves at the time. So mid-70s, they came in back on their own. So it's not really a reintroduction of the wolves into the state. They are a native species. Wisconsin's within their historic range. The animal belongs here on the landscape, as Jamie mentioned, and things of that nature. And, you know, the issue is with a lot of predators, and depending on where you're talking, but especially in a state like Wisconsin, because there's so much human modification of the landscape, and it doesn't matter if it's forestry or agriculture or whatever the case might be, that in areas where you have human settlement, one of the main prey items for wolves is white-tailed deer. And we see white-tailed deer populations typically are at a higher density, or there's more individuals in a defined area than we have had historically. And so it really depends on what you're talking about in terms of reintroduction. But most of the time, because we've upset the balance, if you will, of the ecosystem, that we have also allowed increased densities of prey items to occur, which really tends to support those predator populations, even if they are an increased density of predator populations.
Hmm. And Jamie, anything to add there?
Yeah, I was just going to add two things. One, in terms of the wolf population, there is some evidence in terms of the pack distribution across the state and their population increase that it does appear that the expansion is kind of stopped, that perhaps we are kind of reaching close to what the landscape's carrying capacity might be for wolves, or suitable wolf habitat in the state. And so, you know, the delisting comes at a time where we can, you know, help to maintain the wolf population, but also from a deer population, there's lots of numbers out there, especially northern, you know, we're talking really northern Wisconsin and central forests where the wolves are, that, you know, deer consume, I've seen 17 to 20 deer per wolf, what it averages out to. But there's a lot of other predators or predator load between the fawning season. Black bears can really reduce or have an impact on fawns. But what I would say is that deer population is fairly robust as a prey species, as David was alluding to. But what we have noticed, and I think hunters would report this as well, is that when you have wolf activity in kind of your backyard or the area that you hunt, you may see an absence of deer as they avoid that pack, or a reduced number of deer. And that could vary for a few years. So maybe you have a couple of years where you're not seeing a lot of deer in that very specific area, but then they return as the wolf population perhaps moves to a different area. And again, it's not so direct that it's just wolves and deer and the interplay. There's so much else going on in terms of the forest maturing, and what that habitat looks like and what browse is available for the deer, lots of different pressures. But in terms of what we've seen, I think it's fair to say that we've seen behavioral changes in the deer, very local deer population, but not substantial across the deer population across, you know, the state per se. So hopefully that makes sense, but yeah, it's pretty cool.
And Nancy, I hope that helps. David, you wanted to add one final thing?
I was just gonna add on to what Jamie said. We're focusing on deer, but that's not the only prey item also that wolves will utilize. They also will prey on beavers and elk and other species as well. So it's not just that they're focusing solely on deer either.
And there you go, Nancy. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Norm in Oneida County, it's your turn. We'll get to Norm here in just a second. A reminder that our guests today are David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today on the show, Larry Mueller here with my guests David Drake and Jamie Knack from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension. It's always great to have them come by. Our lines are filled. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, and of course you can try to call at 800-642-1234. Now let's go to Norm in Oneida County. Norm, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Good morning. My question regards the threatened species list. If the wolves are taken off the endangered species list, put on the threatened species list, Wildlife Services still has the authority to take out problem wolves and to help farmers in protecting their cattle. But there would not be a hunting season. I believe Minnesota has this. Why wouldn't we go to a threatened species list?
All right, Jamie, do you want to go in?
So I think you are absolutely correct in what you just stated in terms of the threatened species status. I believe that is true in terms of being able to mitigate damage issues, but no hunting season. I think the science, the data that we have that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is reviewing is that the wolves have recovered to the point that a sustainable regulated harvest is possible within the state to allow opportunities as we do for many other species that are hunted and that too can help reduce the population. And I think many will remember, but we had a season in 2012, 2013 and 2014 before the wolves were delisted again. And I have these numbers here, but they were able to be harvested by both hunters or by hunting or trapping. And it was based on so they had the quota, so the targeted number of wolves they said were, you know, would be acceptable by zone. And so hunters or trappers who were successful in receiving a permit, and that was done, 50% of the permit allocation was a random draw, and 50% of the permit allocation was based on your preference points. If you're familiar with bear permits and how we allocate the bear harvest, that's done by a point system. So you can essentially earn a preference point each year that you apply, so until you have enough points where you are at the top of that drawing and receive a tag. But in those years, for wolves, that, you know, it was incredible to me to see how tightly monitored and controlled that harvest was in terms of reaching within just a couple of animals on either side of the goal, being able to manage carefully for the number of wolves removed. And that required 24-hour registration period, and that registration had to occur in person. And that allowed the state, the DNR, to really watch how those numbers went up and how close we were to that goal, so that by even on a weekend where you saw more hunter success on a weekend per se, they could anticipate that and shut down that zone. And so we saw, I think numbers here were 117 wolves, 257 and 154 in those 3 years that were harvested. And again, within just a few animals of the actual goal, that lowered the wolf population to 660 in 2014. And again, I believe the state's goal was the state's management goal was 350. That wasn't, you know, intended to happen in one season, of course. But then we had the relisting in December of 2014, and that wolf population, looking at subsequent estimates, was back up to 925 animals by 2017. And then we have the today's estimate that David had mentioned earlier. It's just under 1,200 animals. So we do have some, you know, history to look at in terms of being able to successfully have harvest seasons and reduce that population to, again, it's a matter of value or judgment in people's opinions on wolves, but to perhaps a more socially and biologically acceptable level.
Yeah, there you go, Norm. Thank you very much for calling. Let's give Jim in Waupaca a chance to join in. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Part one of my question is, what are some typical average deer herd population target numbers for farmland and wooded zones? And then part two is, what are some contributing factors when establishing the target numbers?
Okay. Who wants to take that?
David, do you want to talk about PDACs a little bit?
Absolutely. I'll start with that, and then Jamie, jump in if you want to. So,
sure.
So I don't know what the specific numbers are in farmlands, because that is typically indicated through guidance with county deer advisory committees, or CDACs. So a county deer advisory committee consists of hunters, non-hunters, other stakeholder groups, and they look at a variety of data in their county to make recommendations to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources in terms of whether the harvest should increase, decrease, or stay roughly the same for the upcoming deer harvest season. And some of the things they look at would be deer vehicle collisions in the county. They look at agricultural damage in the county. They look at hunter success. They look at their biologists' recommendations in terms of deer habitat and how healthy that habitat is. They look at deer counts in the county. And so there's a variety of data that's collected to make those recommendations. But typically that comes through the CDACs and then feeds up to the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
And Jamie?
So it can vary by county.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that there is. So counties would typically have an estimate for the amount of habitat, deer habitat available. And that can be farmland, but they're pretty ubiquitous in terms of where they occur. And so they haven't necessarily been reporting numbers by deer per square miles of suitable habitat. It's more leaving that to the CDAC to make a recommendation on whether to increase, decrease, or remain stable the deer population for that county. And that's kind of the way the DNR has been looking for citizen input and management. I will note, I saw come across, I think earlier today or yesterday, a press release from the Department of Natural Resources discussing the county deer advisory committees. And so there are some committees that are looking to fill vacant seats, and you do have to apply for that. But that is a way that you can get involved in some of the decision making. And you can find that by going to the DNR's website and typing in the abbreviation CDAC, CDAC, and taking a look. You can also look at who is serving on that committee for your respective county, and you can reach out to them with your concerns so they can use that information when they have those discussions.
There you go. Thank you so much, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Michael in Wauwatosa will give you a chance. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Hello, Larry and your esteemed guests. I wanted to give you a perspective from a hunter and also amateur forester. I've got some property in northwestern Shawano County, and it's a good mix of dairy farm, upland woods, and a lot of wooded swamp and wooded bog. And over the years, I've been reclaiming old farmland, planting predominantly oaks, some basswood, some sugar maple, and there is no way that I can get any of those to survive unless I spend really good money on tree shelters and rolls of welded wire. I get 100-foot rolls of welded wire from Fleet Farm. I roll that whole thing out. I cut off the bottom rung so that there's spears, and then I make these cages to put around every tree. And if I don't do that, the deer will lop them down, and there's just no regeneration of hardwoods in the neighboring woodlands. Nothing can get past these deer. So I am thrilled to see that the wolves moved in about 5-6 years ago. I see them on my game cameras. I've seen them, seen their tracks. And they can't take out enough deer as far as I'm concerned, and I'm a hunter. So bring them on.
Michael, well, thank you.
Yeah, I think Michael's comment really, you know, transacts what we're talking about in terms of managing both deer and wolves and the spectrum of different opinions, but that is one metric. So on the CEDAX, I'm sure Michael's aware, there is a forestry representative that helps to provide information in terms of how easy or difficult it is to regenerate forest in that area. And I think Michael's got some strong, you know, evidence locally there in terms of how difficult it is on his own properties. And we see that in different parts of the state where deer densities are higher, and it's inhibiting that regeneration, that planting and regeneration of the forest. So.
Yeah. Michael, thank you. Mike in Rusk County has a view on this as well. Mike, hello.
Hi. You know, so I guess I don't want to sound psychotic here because I know what I'm about to say, but I also am a sympathetic listener to what the previous caller just talked about as a forested landowner and so forth as well. So the challenge that we have here is when we have discussions like we have today, is how to communicate in a way that we keep people engaged. And I'll tell you one thing. The original reason I called was to make a statement that, you know, it is so unsatisfactory when we hear any part of the discussion when we talk about the wolf pack in Wisconsin, that it veers over and some learned person brings up that, well, we have a large deer herd and so forth. Well, most deer hunters are on their own traditional hunting land that they've hunted for, in many cases, decades and decades, or their family has done for decades. And saying that there are lots of deer over there doesn't do them any good when there's a wolf pack sitting on their property and taking their deer hunting experience down to nil. So, but then I understand the other part of it is that, you know, I think it's a good thing to have a large predator in those areas that are clear overbrows. And actually the farmland mixed area is some of the worst cases of overbrows because they have an artificially high food source for part of the year. And then when they get into, when the fields are fallow, then they just take down the forest like you wouldn't, or the new growth in forest like you wouldn't believe. So I guess the thing is that, you know, when we communicate these things, let's just remember that we will keep people engaged and we will keep them listening to our total argument if we don't downplay or overlook that a lot of these guys that are in the deer hunting community, they have a place, a traditional place, and we need to make sure that we don't lose that perspective when we talk about the total deer herd versus the total wolf pack size for the entire state. The best thing we could do, in my opinion, is not talk about the total number of deer and the total number of wolves, but rather talk about how are we managing, like on a county by county or a township by township or whatever level, how are we managing our deer and wolf relationship.
Well, Mike, I thank you very much for calling. Jamie, you want to comment?
Yeah, I do. Mike, I think you're right on, and I think that is very, you know, well put, and it's why I hesitated with the caller in terms of what is the goal? How many deer per square mile? I didn't want to put a number out there, and the department doesn't either, but the idea is the same. The reason why the department doesn't want to put numbers like that in a county, like how many deer per square mile in a given county, because they're not evenly distributed based on habitat or at the property level or, you know, where you're hunting. So to say there's X number of deer out there, that doesn't mean they're available to everybody in the same fashion, and why you end up with hunters who are frustrated because they didn't see anything on the property they had access to compared to other years. Versus, you know, somebody a couple miles away that had an outstanding hunting season. So we have to be careful in our expectations And again, in terms of how we share this information with the public, you know, from a population to a local level response.
Yep.
But I would agree with all that's been said, and only add that I completely agree that we need to have a civil conversation in terms of all these management issues, be it deer, wolves, bears, non-game species, whatever the case is. And the common currency should be science. I mean, we should be following the science that will then dictate the management and biological decisions as to how we manage and steward a variety of resources across the state and really across the world. So I think if we all paid attention and just followed science, I think the conversation would be a lot easier.
And I was just going to say, I think that's exactly right. But we know, David, that we scientists are not always the best communicators in terms of how we package that information and share it. So there's certainly work that can be done in terms of how that information is delivered.
Absolutely. Yep. And Mike, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call very much. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison and UW Extension as well. David involved with that as well. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. In about 15 minutes or so, we'll be taking a look at the latest election results with you on the show. So I hope you'll stay tuned for that. Of course, you can always run over to WPR.org and you'll find the latest information on what's going on with the elections. On this show right now, we're talking wildlife with our guests today, David Drake and Jamie Nack. And if you have questions, we've talked mostly about wolves and deer, but we'll take other wildlife questions as well. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Let's take another call. Ron in Madison, we'll go to you next. Ron, hello.
Thanks. I respect science, but Michael's expensive problem building individual fences around every tree inspires me to spout advice beyond my scientific experience and education. Here goes. Missouri and Wisconsin should limit the whitetail herd to 1 million deer per state. Other folks would say wild turkeys and fantail cranes have also been too successful of a restoration project. So for wolves, let's have at least one pack living in at least one half of the counties in Wisconsin. And when they grow to more than 10 packs in a single county, start a managed hunt. Figure out what's the reasonable number? Do you need 7 packs or 17 packs to balance the whitetail population with the wolf population in that size of county based on how much farmland, how much forest, how much water surface, et cetera? I know that's not officially scientific, but I think a million deer in a state the size of Missouri or Wisconsin is too much. They're eating the trees. Now, we can pay the farmers for the soybeans and the corn, but when they're devouring the national forests, state and county forests, and corporate forests and private forests, we're changing the ecosystem too much by having too many deer eating too many trees.
Well, Ron, I thank you very much for calling. Jamie, do you want to comment?
Well, I would just say it's very difficult. It's very difficult to apply. I mean, the department was trying to do a more uniform regulations licensing across the state for deer hunting to help make it more just easier to follow in terms of the different seasons. So we have a December antlerless season, a holiday season, the 9-day gun deer season. And what happens is the habitat is different throughout the state. Obviously, we have the tension zone separating the northern and southern area of southern farmland. So there's different pressures. So in the southern farmland, we may see more pressure on deer, you know, from deer on crops and regeneration. In the north, if you've been following some of the debates within the Wisconsin Outdoor News, there's very big concern about the number of deer in northern Wisconsin being too few deer. And so it's hard to put a single approach across the state in terms of how many deer, you know, how, and to do something where you said we're going to have a million deer. Well, how are we going to allocate that million deer? Where can they live? Anywhere? Because then you're going to have feuds between northern and southern landowners in terms of who gets the deer. And what do we do in terms of the wolf pack distribution when, you know, just the cost of removing or having that hunting pressure, you know, how do you dictate the removal of a pack versus individual animals through a hunting season structure? So it is definitely a very interesting suggestion, and I can appreciate that. But I also appreciate the data that is driven that goes into the science. In terms of every deer that's harvested in the state is registered, hopefully, by law it's required to be. We get age estimates. We're able to use that information to build models, can break that down to the county level and really look and monitor herd status at a pretty local level and look for those trends. Same with wolves, you know, these wolves that eventually down the road here, if we're able to, you know, continue with the season and harvest, we're able to get that information on the health, the sex ratios, the location of packs, and really monitor. So we have a very strong system of being able to monitor wildlife populations. I think the argument or the discussion that needs to happen is back to what we were talking about earlier. How can Mike regenerate trees on his property in the presence of, in that area, an overabundant deer population, at least in his mind? His neighbor may feel there's not enough deer. And so how do we have those conversations that are more on the social side of things to come up with an answer? And that's where I think, you know, the intention of the CDAC to have those discussions really, really came in and is a step in the right direction. We also have the Deer Management Assistance Program, which is a program that is involves DNR, both foresters and wildlifers, or wildlife biologists coming onto your property, private property, looking at your current browse levels, deer browse levels, looking at what habitat features are there, talking to you about things like your attempts to regenerate the forest, or perhaps you have a mature forest that needs cutting. But with there's no expectation that you have to do what they come up with, but they provide suggestions in terms of what you can do to reach your goals for the habitat, for the wildlife that you're interested in. And they have the ability to issue additional antlerless deer tags to help reduce that pressure from the deer if that's the case. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that too. And that program also puts you in connection with programs and cost share assistance for different habitat activities you might want to pursue on your property.
Ron, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Mike in Vilas County a chance to join in. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Thank you. Yeah, I was just calling in. I'm in Vilas County. I have not been able to get a doe tag with a bow for 10 years or with a firearm, but the places I hunt, their properties are littered with deer feces. They're really overpopulated up here. But my point on this wolf stuff is that, you know, if guys are seeing wolves and complaining about wolves being on their property, there has to be deer there, because if the deer weren't around and we didn't have good populations, they wouldn't be there. And, these wolves aren't static. I mean, they have big ranges of deer. I mean, big ranges for the wolves. And I've found in the past, the numbers on the wolves here, we have a lot of, you know, poaching and stuff where they get shot. I know a couple of years ago they had, even before deer season, they had like 18 collared wolves shot, which extrapolate to quite a few wolves being shot, which affects their population. But, you know, I just wanted to make that point. And then the other thing about people not seeing deer, up here it's not legal to bait, but everybody's baiting and feeding deer, and that's having a bigger effect on these people not seeing deer than, I mean, the wolves aren't chasing deer off. They're moving around and covering large areas.
Well, Mike, I thank you. David, a comment on Mike's thoughts here.
Yeah, those are good points. I think Mike made a good point that certainly the wolves nor the deer are static. I mean, they're moving around all the time, and wolves have very, very large ranges, upwards of 150 square miles sometimes, so, or they can be. So, you know, you may see signs of what might appear to be a decent number of deer in one area, and other areas you may not at that particular time. And it may have to do with the predator-prey relationship. It may have to do with the amount of available browse for the deer. It might have to do with people artificially moving deer. I shouldn't say artificially moving deer, but deer moving in ways they may not if there's concentrated bait piles. And hopefully that's not the case, because that has implications for chronic wasting disease, and there's reasons that they have bait restrictions in place in parts of the state. So it's not as simple to manage wildlife as, you know, if it was easy to count the wildlife, we'd know exactly how many deer and how many wolves were in the state. It's just not that simple, because they do move around a lot, and it's a very dynamic system that they're in.
Mike, thank you so much. Let's give Bill in Washburn a chance to join in. Bill, hello to you.
Hello. What I wanted to point out is it appears there's no mention of the number of doe permits that are given out here in Bayfield County. A couple of years ago or so, we had 5,000 of them, and Bayfield County is relatively small. But that 5,000 eliminated the breeding stock for that particular duration. So to me, it has to be a balance of the permits that are given, because a lot of people from Minnesota come over and claim for $12. There's no shortage. They can shoot any deer they want. But I think it must be a balance, and of making the wolf a game animal, just like they do with a bear and bobcats and stuff like that. And I think somewhere along the line, the balance will come out, and we'll end up with a good deer herd in northern Wisconsin. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Yeah.
Jamie, you go ahead.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. And I think, you know, many share your concern. And that's why I think you've seen some, you know, a lot of the CDAC counties in the north either asking for a stable herd status or to increase the northern herd. And I think if I recall correctly, there's one county that still has a buck only for this coming season. But if you recall a few years past, we've had a number of northern counties that had no antlerless harvest. And again, we look to either blame how many permits were issued or on the wolf population, but there's also the winter severity index, or how harsh our winters are and what that fawn reproduction looks like, that play into the year's worth of pressure that a deer has on it. So there's other, it's just very complicated. There's no, you know, A, B, cause C. There's lots of players in managing these populations. And we're talking at times today, we're talking about social decisions and, you know, what the human interest is. And then we've got the biological, between the habitat conditions and the interplay between predators and winter severity indexes. So it's quite complicated. It's fascinating, but it's complicated, and it is really hard to please everybody with the outcome.
And I wondered if current Wisconsin statutes permit hunting wolves with dogs. She considers this as legalized dog fighting, and if so, if dogs are killed in those circumstances, would they get $2,500 per dog killed while hunting?
So I'm going to go back to 2012 through 2014 when we had the last season, and I don't know with the state statute. So that, you know, requires when they're delisted that you have a hunting season, but that doesn't dictate the quota. So you could have I guess theoretically you could have a zero harvest, right? But back in those 3 years, you could use dogs to pursue wolves. Although I think if you talk to folks up there that use dogs on bears or coyotes and have already been, you know, kind of tiptoeing around wolf packs, they're uneasy about that, or they're being very cautious about perhaps only pursuing a single wolf rather than a pack of wolves. But I think most of that harvest is done, you know, through hunting or trapping in the past. And so I believe dogs would still be allowed to be used, but that might be something that the state can still make a change.
Have a voice
to.
In. Yeah, have a voice in. Okay. David Drake and Jamie Nack will be with us up until 12:30 today to talk about the world of wildlife. We've certainly talked deer and wolves. We can take other questions as well at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. So other questions certainly welcome as well. We'll find out about election results and a whole lot more news coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for being with us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking the world of wildlife today on the show. But just a reminder, WPR and NPR news teams are following the election results, as you've just heard, and we'll keep you up to date throughout the day for sure. And I hope you'll join us tonight at 8 o'clock for an NPR election update special. We'll have the latest election news from around the country here in Wisconsin Public Radio. Or, of course, just go online anytime at WPR.org and you'll get the latest up-to-the-minute information. So glad to let you know that. And glad to let you know that David Drake and Jamie Nack are still with us from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. Always great to have them come by. They come by every other month on the first Wednesday of the month. And nice to have them with us. You can join in with your own questions. Maybe you have a question about deer or wolves, but maybe you have another wildlife question. We'd certainly love to hear from you as well at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Gabby in Madison, it's your turn. Gabby, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, I live in the Cambridge area, so kind of out in the country, and every night I hear the pack of, it's either wolves or coyotes, you know, one will go off, and then a whole bunch will go off in different areas, and thinking they're telling each other where they're hunting or something. So I'm wondering if it's coyotes or wolves, or how do you tell the difference? I got to see one that went across the road when I was driving. It looked like a dog at first, but it was grayish, and it was running and looked happy.
Okay. Gabby, we'll let David, you want to take that?
Sure, I'll take that. Hi, Gabby. So for those of you listening who may not be familiar with where Cambridge is, that's in Dane County here in the southern part of the state. And so it is almost certain to be coyotes, or coyotes, however you want to pronounce it. And not wolves. Wolves have made forays down into this part of the state, into the southern part of the state in years past, and will continue to do so periodically. But coyotes are a permanent resident here in this part of the state, as they are in other parts of the state. And so it's likely you're hearing coyotes, and they are calling. They're starting to get ready for breeding season, so that's part of the reason they call. They call in response to train whistles and sirens, and they call to stay in communication with each other and for a variety of other reasons. And how do you tell the two apart? It's hard with the howling, although typically with wolves, the howl is a much lower register than coyotes are. But wolves are about upwards of 100 pounds for a full-grown male. Coyotes are upwards of 40 pounds for a full-grown male. So wolves are much bigger, twice the size, longer-legged animal. Wolves have shorter, rounded ears. Coyotes have taller, more triangular ears. And the coyote's face generally and its snout is much more elongated and thin relative to a wolf, which is much more kind of stout and much more full in the face and a shorter nose. But again, if you only see one animal and you've never seen a coyote or a wolf, it's hard to determine that because everything's relative. But those would be some of the things you would look for.
Yeah, probably a coyote in Cambridge area for sure, though.
Yeah, yep, for sure.
Thanks, Gabby. Appreciate it. Russ in Lone Rock, your turn. Hi, Russ.
Hi, guys. My question, I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer or not, but it relates to elk in Wisconsin. So I think, you know, most people know that they've been reintroduced. And recently, within the last several weeks, I guess, I've personally seen a few reports of elk being captured on trail cameras in Richland County and in Crawford counties. And so I don't really know what the vision for elk is in Wisconsin, but I'm just kind of curious if there would be any insights as to what the goal is if herds were to migrate and populate southwest Wisconsin. Would there be a concerted effort to relocate them, or would they be allowed to proliferate in our area? And I'll take the answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling. Jamie, you want to take a crack at that?
Thank you for the call. And I'll try to keep this pretty brief, but we have two populations of elk, the original Clam Lake elk herd in northern Wisconsin, and then in the Black River Falls, Jackson County area, where we've had some new introductions from the last couple years with elk from Kentucky. In terms of the huntable population, there was a 200-animal goal for that Clam Lake area for them to be hunted, and I think this is the second year of an elk hunt in northern Wisconsin specific to that Clam Lake herd. I think the state is very closely monitoring movements of these elk, and you probably realize that many of them are radio collared, especially in that Jackson County herd that's rather new. And, you know, I think for the most part, it's a hands-off approach. But if the elk wander and start to cause damage or concern, then I think a team comes together and decides how best to handle that, whether that be some hazing or non-lethal techniques used to drive the elk out of that area, or whether that be anesthetizing an animal and moving it back to the Jackson County area. So I think it's very much treated on a case-by-case basis. And you called talking about elk that's being sighted in Richland County, but many will be familiar with an elk that has been showing up in the southeastern part of the state in an area near Hubertus. And so, let's see, that bull elk has an ear tag on it. So DNR was able to confirm that that was an elk from the Jackson County herd. It's traveled at least 170 miles southeast of Black River Falls. It would be a young bull, and likely that movement is a direct result of elk being approaching or in the rutting behavior looking for mates, and likely wandering to look for mates and expand a little bit. And it's been spotted in Dodge, Fond du Lac, Washington, and Waukesha County. So again, just kind of watching what this animal does, and perhaps it will turn around and head back to the rest of the herd in Jackson County. But nevertheless, the folks that have been picking this up on a trail camera, or the one the callers mentioned in Richland County, I can imagine what people look when they go through their trail camera photos and then see these, you know, just huge bulls. So it's a good time to also remind people, as we're on the heels of the 9-day gun deer season, to understand that elk could be theoretically anywhere in the state, and to be very careful about identifying your target. We have moose occasionally in the state as well, and obviously domestic animals, and it's just very important that you identify your target. So, but fun to have them here and watch as they are increasing their population.
Yep, for sure.
Larry, I'll just mention really quick one thing also, since we've been talking about deer and elk quite a bit, now elk, but deer quite a bit, is that we are in the heart of the rut right now. So this is typically when most deer vehicle collisions occur in the state of Wisconsin. So as you're driving, and especially with the change in daylight savings time, just be very, very careful as you're driving along, especially when you get into areas with woods along the road you're driving on. that you, if you see a deer and elk, you do all you can to avoid it. If you can, break, but please be safe and make sure you protect yourself and your occupants in your vehicle.
Good points. Let's go to Nick in Green Bay. Nick, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a problem. I love my birds, and I put up sweat feeders, and I don't buy them anymore. I'm an investor in the company because I've got a raccoon that keeps taking them, and I don't know where the thing goes, but it just disappears. I was wondering if you have any suggestions besides the 22 to deter that thing from taking my sweat feeders and having lunch.
Okay. Oh, man.
Well, I'm happy to start. And I guess, you know, one obvious response would be, you know, how are you hanging those suet feeders? Can we think of a way to still allow the suet but prohibit access by the raccoons? Because I promise you, if you start and you're legally able to trap or in a case where you can discharge a firearm, you may certainly harvest those raccoons, but it will be an unending battle for you. So if we can address the problem by coming up with a way to creatively hang those suet feeders to not allow access, and one that comes to mind for me is something that we do or suggest with bears as well. And you can pull those suet feeder in, but I appreciate you wanting to feed birds. But can you thread cut pieces of a garden hose over a clothesline string with that suet feeder hanging in the middle from tree to tree that makes it difficult for the raccoon to climb out on that garden hose, which it's going to spin, and access that feeder and yet still make that feeder available for the birds? So, you know, what can we come up with to keep the raccoons off? The other thing would be if you have that mounted on a post, can you put a baffle at the bottom of the post that the raccoon cannot get around to climb up? And then obviously that post needs to be 6 feet or more away from any overhanging branches that a raccoon could use to get access. David, do you have any other thoughts?
Any other comments?
Those are all good suggestions. I mean, obviously you can take your suet feeder down, and you may just take it down for a couple of weeks and let the raccoon find another food source and then put the feeder back up and see what happens. You may try to take some suet and put it into smaller chunks and scatter it, either adhere it to directly to the tree or something like that, and don't use the feeder at all. The other thing, if you can get a hold of a deer rib cage, just adhere a deer rib cage to a tree or a pole, and you'll get titmice and the nuthatches and the woodpeckers and all the things that typically would come to the suet. They'll come and eat the cartilage off of the ribs of the deer, as long as you don't mind having a deer rib cage hanging in your yard someplace.
That's another way to do it. Thank you very much for that question. Jim and Rhinelander, it's your turn. Jim, hello.
Hello. I'd like someone to explain to me the whole communal pooping, peeing, and scenting party that I see otters taking part in. It's pretty comical, and, you know, it's something they're always doing. I was wondering if it's the same, all the otters are from the same family group, or, you know, are they from different family groups, and what is the whole idea of that?
Jamie, do you know anything about that?
Sure. And they call that area where they're depositing, so their toilet is called a latrine, and it's not uncommon for some of those weasel-like animals, like the otter, to use a latrine where they, you know, return to for marking. So they would have territories as well, like we see with coyotes or fox and other animals that protect or maintain a territory. And that latrine is, you know, full of scent that allows other otters to analyze and determine who's occupying that territory. So it's not uncommon. I mean, coyotes, fox do the same thing. They patrol their territory. Bucks are doing it right now over their scrapes, where they're scraping up the ground and peeing on it. And then they're constantly traveling around that area to monitor who's been visiting. So I would guess it's they're most likely related individuals, but I would assume, like it for other wildlife, you might have an unrelated animal, otter, defecate or urinate on that latrine to, again, you know, try to establish territory or let the others know that they're in the area. So I don't know, David, do you have any other?
No, I think
anything else to add? Yeah.
Nope, I think you covered it nicely. So yeah, it's okay. Common amongst a lot of the weasel species. Minks do it and otters and other animals do it.
Yeah, there you go, Jim. Thank you. Well, let's go to Christina in Madison next. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. My question is a wolf pack question, and I don't know if it was dealt with earlier in the program, but it concerns the criterion, the DNR metrics with the hunt. I'm wondering, there's the emphasis on a population number and keeping the number within a certain metric, but what about the relationship aspect with the packs? Are biologists monitoring what wolves are the alpha wolves, and wouldn't hunting like arbitrarily like get rid of like the more valuable members that whose DNA you'd want to continue into the next generation? Do you get what I'm asking?
I think so. Yeah, David?
Yep, yeah. Yeah, so wolves are they're very hierarchical, and obviously, as you've identified, they have a dominant male, dominant female, and subordinates, and operate as kind of a pack or a family. And so there's a lot of research that's been gone, looked into what happens when you perhaps lethally remove via trapping or gets hit by a car, or whatever the case is, you lethally remove the alpha or dominant male. And typically what happens is that the animals just resort themselves. So you have another, you'll have another male who will then become the dominant male. And in areas where you have wolves that are kind of interseeded amongst human populations and human-dominated landscapes and things like that, there probably is a decent amount of wolf pack turnover anyway, either from disease or wolves getting hit by cars or wolves dying in other ways. Even if there's not a harvest season on those wolves. But so there's probably some relatively regular pack upset anyway. And those animals, they sort themselves out, and that's just part of the natural inclination of being a pack or a hierarchical animal.
Christina, thank you again. Appreciate it. Maxine in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Maxine.
Hi. I have a suggestion for the man who called in about raccoons and the eating the suet.
Yeah.
We have found at Wild Birds Unlimited suet that has hot pepper sauce in it, and the raccoons don't like it, and neither do the squirrels. We haven't had any problems since we started using that. It's a little more expensive, but it beats buying a $75 raccoon baffle for the pole.
Yeah. And what that does is, so raccoon being a mammal, mammals have a very well-developed sense of taste. We've got a lot of different nerve endings on our soft palate, like our tongue and the roof of our mouth. Birds don't have that developed sense of taste, so they're not affected by that hot sauce or that heat that's in the suet. And that's been common for squirrels, for example, that you'll use capsaicin, that hot pepper sauce or hot pepper, and you mix it with the bird seed, put it in your feeders, and it can work very, very well. But other times, squirrels and even raccoons are not that susceptible to that. So it really depends on the personal preference of that individual squirrel or raccoon in that local area. But it can work, and that might be an option if you want to try it. And if it's working, keep doing it. If it's not working, you may have to get a little bit more creative.
All right. Maxine, I appreciate that. Thank you so much for calling. I didn't know they even sold it that way, so it's interesting. Somebody was wondering about the pandemic. Has the pandemic helped or hurt wildlife? JB, what do you think?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, we know, and this is kind of tangential, but I would say it's going to help wildlife. And the reason I say that is more and more people are spending time outside or immediately around their homes and noticing wildlife. So David, I'm sure can agree with this, but we're getting more phone calls, more emails,
just with general ecology questions. You know, why is this animal doing this, or what is this animal? Certainly for me, I'm you know, have more time immediately around my home where I'm spending time, and then being able to see animals and notice them. So I'd like to think that people will spend more time doing habitat work, maybe feeding birds this winter. I would suspect that that would increase. Now's a great time to dabble in that, because you'll be home to fill feeders and enjoy the rewards of watching the birds. So we know camping, hunting, many of those reservations and license sales have increased pretty substantially. So I can only think that the more time we spend outdoors and in nature, the more we, you know, look to protect and you know, increase it.
Yeah. David, you were going to add something.
I was just going to mention, I saw a headline last week that I think tens of millions of dollars in terms of license fees and equipment to go outside has been increased over years past. And all that money, either directly or indirectly, does feed into wildlife management. So I think the pandemic is both directly and indirectly helping wildlife.
You mentioned earlier that that badgers are not true hibernators. Someone else wondered which animals are true hibernators.
Well, so bats are.
No, please go ahead, David. That's good.
Yep. So bats are, bears are, groundhogs or woodchucks, all are. Some things that are, are jumping mice. We've got a couple of different species of jumping mice. They're true hibernators. Some examples of restive hibernators would be like chipmunks and 13-legged ground squirrels, where they might hibernate or sleep for 2 or 3 weeks at a time, and then they'll wake up periodically, go to the bathroom, eat, and go back to sleep for 2 or 3 more weeks. So that doesn't sound like such a bad retirement plan.
I guess not. And well, on that one more quick thing.
Really quick thing. So I would just add that the definition of hibernation is pretty loose. So some would argue that bears are not true hibernators, that they're light sleepers. And one of the qualifications, and if you think about it, they have their young. They give birth during the winter. So it depends on how we define the hibernator. But amazing adaptations and physiological processes that animals go through to survive the winter. So,
Jamie and David, thank you so much. I look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much. Thanks. You're back January 6th, I believe.
That sounds great.
Thank you, Larry.
All right. Thank you very much. Just a reminder, hope you join us tonight at 8 o'clock for an NPR election update special with the latest election news from around the country. We're here on Wisconsin Public Radio, of course. Or, you know, throughout the day, just go online anytime to WPR.org and you'll get the latest updates on what's going on with the election. Tomorrow, we'll talk with the author of a book that chronicles growing up in a small town at 11:45. More shows as well. I'm Larry Mealy. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us.